Tonight, sunset 5:54, cloudy and cool. Rain moving in after midnight. Tonight's low 48. Friday, a cloudy morning, a sunny afternoon, and a high of 61. Right now, sunshine, 41 degrees for both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm happy once again to be sitting opposite Dr. Art Sear, a monthly visitor to the morning show. He has been a faithful element to the morning show for more than two decades, offering his thoughtful analysis and commentary on a number of different issues. And in so many cases, as will be the case with a couple of things we talk about today, talking about really important and substantive matters that tend to not necessarily generate big headlines, but are important matters that we should be talking about. And I know that many of you have enjoyed Professor Sear's columns over the years that appear in newspapers all across the country. He's also author of After the Cold War, and as I said, a monthly visitor to the morning show, and we appreciate his presence on the program very much. Professor Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be here. You're always so kind, whether it's a sunny day or not, and it's a great way to start the day,
right.
including listening to the morning show, those who may be tuning in who aren't your regular listeners.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I'm glad Mother Nature gave you a pleasant day for the drive up from Illinois.
No, it's pretty good this morning.
Right.
Not always the case.
Right. So I've been looking at your recent columns, and you indeed touch on some matters that are really, really interesting. And, you know, honestly, it's nice to think about something besides the current presidential race in which we are embroiled, although we will certainly touch on that in just a little bit, at least briefly.
Gee, do we have to?
But let's talk first of all about the column that you wrote about this company called SpaceX.
Of course,
Elon Musk's company that has done some truly dramatic things in in recent years and very, very recently. And in this column, you take the opportunity to kind of, in a sense, lay a historical foundation, as you often do, and talking about, in a sense, how we got here. And it is partly a story of President John F. Kennedy and an aspect of his leadership that is shamefully neglected. I mean, we all are acquainted with that famous speech he gave about the goal of sending a man to the moon and returning him safely before the decade is out, something which ultimately did happen, although he didn't live long enough to see it.
Yes, he was always very careful to add, return him safely to Earth,
yeah.
Which was a good touch.
Yes, but your column touches on another aspect of President Kennedy's leadership that sadly is very much neglected, and that is the whole matter of the satellite-based communications network, which now we take utterly for granted, but which makes so much of our modern lives possible. Tell our listeners about what President Kennedy helped to do, building on some of the initial ideas of his predecessor, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, in this regard.
JFK was a relatively conservative Democrat, something we forget today in all the mist and hagiography and false and fake information connected with Kennedy and the Kennedy family, and in contrast to his two surviving brothers, especially Ted Kennedy. Kennedy was not particularly liberal. He outflanked not only Richard Nixon, but the majority of his party competitors for the nomination in 1960 by being on the right on foreign policy, by being more hardline. By ironically taking a very aggressive stance toward Cuba, given the way events unfolded during his administration. And in fact, he privately, it's in reliable historical sources, he privately confided to people that if he didn't get the nomination, he planned to vote for Nixon. They were friends before the 60 campaign, unfortunately, that ended. They'd actually gone on a golfing vacation together to pre-Castro Cuba.
Wow.
In the 50s, without their wife. The odd couple, for sure, anyway.
Yeah, right.
And he and his father had given financial donations to Nixon, starting with his congressional race right after the war. Anyway, Kennedy was emphatic that telecommunications had to be a privately chartered corporation. Mind you, Eisenhower had started down that road. The Communications Satellite Corporation, which is a foundation for the vast, not only voice communications, but data communications, crucial to the global banking industry today, was chartered during the Kennedy administration, and he insisted it be a private corporation and took considerable heat from Democrats, Southern Democrats who were conservative, very troublesome on race relations, as everyone knows, I hope. But they were populists, and especially from the Great Depression, only two decades after the Depression, where you know they would beat the anti-business, especially anti-banking drums. Kennedy faced heat from them and also populist Western Democrats, but he insisted that it be a private corporation. That would be more efficient and more effective and open the door. He was undeniably, whatever one might think of him as a president, he was extraordinarily visionary. He had some trouble with implementation. But that vision was extremely important to Lyndon Johnson's very phenomenally successful implementation of policy. But he was not particularly liberal. And I'm convinced the more I learn that that's true, but you never see a reference, partly because liberal academics tend to be the ones who and liberal journalists today tend to be the ones who address these issues.
Interesting.
Well, thank you. I'm glad it is interesting. I tend to go on sometimes,
no,
so feel
great.
Free to cut me off.
Yeah, no, it's
great. You're the politest media guy I know.
So what in your view, would have been bad about the alternative if this possibility had not been pursued with primarily a private corporation? I mean, I guess the alternative would have been for the government itself to try to have undertaken that. How do you foresee that? How do you surmise that would have gone if Kennedy had bowed to this pressure and not engaged with the private sector in the way that he did? Would this have even happened at all?
Well, I actually don't know if it's, yes, it would have happened because the pressures were so determined. Yes, telecommunications would have happened. I honestly don't know. I've been around long enough to know I'm very bad at predicting the future. I'm great at talking about the past, whether it's my own personal life or, you know, the world at large.
Right.
But it would have been a government program that more slow-moving, less efficient. The European Union, as well as the Soviet Union, could have gotten much more aggressively into the act, and things wouldn't have worked as well. Only 10 years after Kennedy's death, the international banking industry, I mean, they seized the opportunity that CompSat represented. And believe it or not, before 1973, you couldn't transfer money electronically. You know, they had big-time bankers or their agents had to carry letters of credit across the Atlantic on airplanes or ships or across the Pacific. Increasingly, it was very, very slow motion. So my prediction is that it would have been much more slow moving. And that's not to be underestimated. The sense of adventure that Kennedy personified faded very dramatically thanks to Vietnam and Watergate and stagflation of the 70s and the terrible violence of the 60s and Nixon having to resign. And we basically got out of this long-distance space adventure, except for the rather cautious shuttle program, which was significant, but stayed close to Earth. It was a very cautious, careful, homebound attitude toward the world, and we were completely dependent on Russians for rockets. Think of it. What space program we had was completely dependent on Russian technology and rockets in the 90s. That's how sad sack we had become. And it's thanks to private entrepreneurs. Musk is the most aggressive, most successful, and the most unavoidable, I tell you. It's for a big business leader, I can see why it gets along with Trump. He's everywhere, which is unusual. But that's what saved us, and we're back in business in a big way and going deep into space in a big way. And I applaud that. That's the best way to go through life.
Sense of adventure.
Get away from mom eventually. Yeah. You got to do it, guys.
Right.
Too many guys are not, frankly.
So for those who have not followed this particular story very closely, just capsulize, if you would, the kind of aggressiveness that you're talking about in terms of Elon Musk's company, SpaceX. I mean, what they have already accomplished and what they are setting out to do now in the relatively near future.
Well, I think it was... just last weekend, on Sunday.
Very, very recently,
they tested the... I know I should know that since this current column's about that, but I'll tell you, it's kind of a tough couple of weeks. The biggest, by far the biggest booster in history for the most gigantic rocket in history, which now realistically we can send men and women to Mars. I don't think it's going to happen soon, but NASA is scheduled, and it's because of the technology and innovation that people like Musk and Bezos, another complicated character, the founder of Amazon, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. Blue Horizon is his space, and he sent at least one group of people to paying customers, almost all of them, to the edge of space. Not only was the SpaceX rocket the biggest ever, phenomenally, almost unbelievably powerful, but the booster was recovered. Everyone should look at it on YouTube. It's readily available. The booster, which used to crash, and they actually recovered considerable assets and saved a lot of money by recovering this booster. Just incredible engineering.
Wow.
And that's more likely to come from private enterprise than the public sector.
Fascinating story. For those of you
it is fascinating, and people who don't see space as fascinating today, actually get into it, it's extraordinarily exciting, and it is reminiscent of the atmosphere, the frustration during the Eisenhower years, with lack of aggressive policies that Kennedy brilliantly captured to come from out of nowhere to become president.
Mm. By the way, in your column, you do make mention of another important matter that doesn't always get thought about, and that is the matter of what role the U.S. military should have, first of all, in our space program and actually in space. And you remind us that, you know, there are complicated interests at play there, and we need to be
very dangerous careful. Interests.
Yes. Yes. We need to be careful and responsible about that. How do you see
complicated that? Complicated is too polite.
Right.
Excuse me.
How do you see that playing out in this current scenario, especially involving entities like SpaceX?
I think it will be a complicated conflict. Hmm. And I think there are a lot of interests that will be a drag on militarizing space. Eisenhower, when he left office, warned about the military-industrial complex. Watched that speech, readily available probably too much on the Internet. Watched that speech. He warned about the concentrated, dangerous power of a huge military, a permanent military, which is new in the United States. We had no permanent military outside of the very specialized and traditional Navy before World War II. But we now have a permanent military establishment. We needed one during the Cold War. It is self-perpetuating. And I believe we need one today. He warned about that concentrated power. Eisenhower worked very hard to keep the military out of space. He also was against manned spaceflight. Hmm. In some ways, Ike was almost too practical. He believed we should be in space, but it should be instruments. Humans in space, incredibly dangerous, incredibly expensive, and incredibly inefficient, all of which is true in the short run. And Kennedy obviously grabbed the ball and took a very different point of view. Eisenhower believed that he faced reality. He believed that military test pilots, military personnel were the best astronauts. And for the initial phase of the space program in the space race, I agree with that. But he was firmly against any kind of military role. Lyndon Johnson, despite the incredible pressures of his tenure in the White House in the Vietnam War, which finally consumed him and drove him out, got a space treaty in 1968 demilitarizing space. Ronald, which is I believe we've forgotten about it, but we've never reneged it on it, like other things that Trump simply threw away. Ronald Reagan was transfixed by the notion of Star Wars and exotic weapons in space. And a lot of money was spent, but nothing ever really got done. Trump has, in the White House, actually established a space force, which is in being. It's not much in the news. I don't know exactly what's going on, but I can assure you the Pentagon bureaucracy is working assiduously to militarize space, and the Russians are already doing that under Putin. So it's that dimension is inherently dangerous. Right. And like a lot of the most important issues implied by what you said about the presidential race, we're not talking about it.
Right. Not like
we should be. Yeah. The deficit, military dangers, we're not talking about them. We used to talk about those things.
For those of you just joining us, speaking today with Professor Art Sear, joining me today for his monthly visit to the morning show. I want to turn to another column that is related to technology, but in a different way. And this involves primarily that company called Google.
Oh, yeah, one of the big,
And this is a really interesting column that talks about this whole matter of monopoly and what is a monopoly and what was a monopoly in 1924 and what is a monopoly in 2024. And at least the headline that you suggested for this column is something about, you know, the danger of monopolies. And and what kind of a threat to our collective well-being does a monopoly pose in this current scenario versus the way it used to work or worked a century ago with enormous monopolies like, for instance, Standard Oil, which you write about. So first of all, maybe remind our listeners about recent events involving Google, which prompted you to want to write about this, and then we'll explore the way in which you actually do kind of frame this interesting issue.
Our Justice Department is rain or shine, whichever party is in office, especially when the Democrats are in office. But even when the Republicans, especially the populist Republicans, under the current party, under Trump's leadership, that we are very aggressive in pursuing antitrust cases. And the European Union is very aggressive as well, but they think more in terms of penalizing large corporate entities, as I understand the extremely complicated legal complexities, rather than breaking them up. But both the Europeans and the Americans have gone after these big high-tech companies, and I think that's all in the public interest and in the public good. There are two Justice Department cases, at least, against Google currently, including a new one that involves a criminal dimension. It's not just civil. It's extremely important. It may well lead to the breakup of the company. In any case, I'm not particularly pro-concentrated power, but I can't see a way in which, in any obvious sense, these big current corporations, whether it's Amazon, Google, Walmart, you name it, beyond those in the headlines. You mentioned Standard Oil, the John D. Rockefeller Trust, which was the focus of the first big antitrust case, I think in the 1890s. Rockefeller and his small group of financial associates controlled the U.S. economy. They owned the railroads. They owned oil wells. They owned oil fields, what was in the ground. The production of oil and kerosene, which was more important in the 1800s, was completely controlled by the trust. They could shut down the U.S. Navy. They could badly hamper the U.S. Army. They weren't going to do that, but that was truly dangerous, concentrated power. And I don't see any of these corporations today wielding that kind of power.
What is the difference? I mean,
they don't physically control the economy.
Okay.
Now they have tremendous influence over consumer behavior, and there's a lot that's corrupting about the internet, and there's a lot that's very ruthless about the way these big companies operate, especially Amazon. So I'm not applauding them. You know, I'm not any company has its, any very large company has its good points and its bad points, and concentrated power is inherently dangerous. But none of them individually, and even all of them together, don't have the kind of sheer physical control over the economy that the Rockefeller Trust did. Or early in the 1900s, Theodore Roosevelt had to go to J.P. Morgan. The U.S. government needed a loan from J.P. Morgan's banking conglomerate in order to maintain financial stability during a financial panic. That directly led to the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. And for the first time, we actually had a continuous central bank. The founders had tried it, but it was it died out. Then it was established. Then Andrew Jackson destroyed it. Lincoln and Salmon P. Chase, the Secretary of the Treasury, made phenomenal gains in putting together a national financial system, but not a permanent bank. It wasn't until 1913. Think of it, that we got a J.P. Morgan. Again, he could turn on or turn off the American financial economy. Theodore Roosevelt was rightly applauded as a trust buster, and he was from the old upper class and got along with big business types, and it all worked out. But, you know, the President of the United States shouldn't have to go hat in hand to any capitalist to bail out the American economy.
I think most of us would certainly agree with that. By the way,
well, that's good.
Yeah, as
most
you...
of us on NPR, but I'm not sure everybody in the wider America today would.
One of the interesting points made in this column, when you talk about, for instance, the breakup of Standard Oil, you talk about a remarkable woman, and I must confess, I did not know this name nor anything about Ida Tarbell.
Ida Tarbell.
Right.
Right.
And I suspect there are a few listeners with us as well who do not know the story of this extraordinary woman and what she managed to accomplish as an investigative reporter.
Yeah, she was. She did not come from any great limitations. Her family, they were not enormously rich, but they were well-off people, especially by the standards of the 19th century. She was extremely adventurous when she was still young. She moved to Paris for a few years. She was from a Jewish family that emphasized education and culture as usual. That was a very, that kind of thing happens all the time today, but that was extraordinarily. She must have taken a lot of heat and gotten strange looks, including from other women at the time. No, she just went off on her own to Paris. She was something of a bohemian. And spent a few years there. She could always make a living. She was a great writer, and she was very adventurous. Her family, I believe, was in Pennsylvania, in oil, in or around oil fields that had been that had created a lot of pollution and just a lot of physical problems in the neighborhood. And she became a kind of strident, dedicated reformer. So she wrote a very in-depth book about the Standard Oil Trust, and that generated enough public interest and political heat that it helped fuel, if I may say so, put it that way, the antitrust movement of the 1890s. But she moved to Paris, she moved to New York, quite extraordinary for a single woman. But women have always, whether it's anti-slavery or temperance, or the suffrage movement, of course, women have always played an extremely important role in reforming. Ida Tarbell, I mean, that's true historically, whatever the current ideology may be. Ida Tarbell, though, was extraordinarily intelligent and extraordinarily able to get things done. So everybody should be aware of her.
Right.
And, you know, I like to mention her name. I've mentioned her in other columns.
Right. I'm glad to know of her and of her legacy. And you finish out this column again, which is primarily about Google and the legal challenges that it is facing with two, you know, essentially simultaneous federal prosecutions.
Yeah, no, and the feds are after you. That's serious.
Yeah,
it really
absolutely.
Is.
You finish your column by saying, "Technology properly regulated benefits us," and there is no question. For all the dark sides that are also a part of technology as it plays out, there's no question that all of us have benefited in extraordinary ways by these technological breakthroughs. How tough is it, however, to properly regulate technology, especially as it explodes so quickly? I mean, it moves so rapidly. And how does even one go about doing that and even kind of thinking about how we properly regulate technology?
Well, we've done a pretty good job, actually, in this country. We are a very free country. I think the average American is more well off. The average American is more well off than ever before in history. And technology, the most basic technological revolutions have benefited the average person. If it weren't for Standard Oil and the car companies, which again became a concentrated industry very quickly, the average American by the 1920s, the average American could afford an automobile, not the average European or the average guy anywhere else in the world, but we have done a very good job of harnessing technology. Ida Tarbell was able to travel relatively safely because there was light. I don't mean in a biblical sense, in the technological sense. Streetcars were not only increasingly efficient, moving thanks to electricity rather than wood or coal, but they were well lighted. Trains were well lighted, and a woman could feel safe in a city when that had not been the case in the past. We tend to mythologize the good old days. A woman, you wouldn't see a woman alone, even on Park Avenue in New York, until the 20th century. And there was the assumption that she was a working girl or a prostitute. But quite beyond that, anybody might be attacked on dark streets, even in wealthy areas. Tom Clawson, the former head of Bank of America and the World Bank, liked to say the good old days have not yet arrived. And
They weren't so good.
brief declarations, but I always thought that one was the most insightful. Yeah, we do romanticize the past.
Sure, sure.
So technology really does benefit us overall, especially in a free society.
Right.
I do think the concentrated military corporate power is a growing danger, and we don't discuss that at all. That's a separate program, but I am personally convinced that's a very serious threat to Americans. And like other big problems, we just ignore it.
We're speaking with Dr. Art Sear, and he is paying his monthly visit to the program. Speaking of the military, you did write recently about North Korea and what appears to be North Korea's decision to supply troops to Russia, aiding in their war in Ukraine. And, of course, in certain quarters, this has raised all kinds of alarm bells. You don't see it as a particularly dramatic development. I think you see it as just one more step in the connection between what you call two already close but weak partners.
Weak.
Yeah, and both of them struggling a lot in different ways. I mean, it still doesn't make them any less than kind of unsettling presence on the world stage, but I think you're cautioning us from, in a sense, overreacting to this development.
Yeah, well, it's not new for one thing. The North Korea has been sending workers. They're sending, according to this report, several thousand laborers as well as soldiers to Russia. And I don't, neither Moscow nor Pyongyang, I believe, has acknowledged it, but South Korea, the South Korea government, with big fanfare, announced this latest development, but it's not news. For many years, there are lots of North Korean men working, and boys, working in the Gulf, in Saudi Arabia, in poor but resource-rich nations that need a lot of manual labor. The North Koreans send these men. In fact, North Korea is a criminal state going beyond this report. It is a gangster state in the sense that they are busy peddling arms, liquor. They're in the drug business, girls and women for vice purposes. Pyongyang is busy trying to get desperately needed hard cash by sending these, by this kind of trade, illegal activity. It is a criminal state. Russia is in a desperate situation. Literally thousands of young men are fleeing the country or going into hiding because they don't want to be drafted. I do believe that Russia may well be able to confirm their hold on eastern Ukraine. But what Putin clearly thought was going to be a cakewalk, a walkover, that he could beat his breast about, has turned into a tremendous disaster for Russia.
Yeah, you say Russia's assumption that Ukraine would be an easy conquest has proven disastrously wrong. In contrast to North Korea and what you call its desperate economic...
It's really desperate.
Difficulty. Yeah.
Why they don't collapse is quite interesting.
Right. You set in contrast to lonely North Korea this thing called RIMPAC, Rim of the Pacific. And what an extraordinary event this is as it plays out biennially. Describe to our listeners who maybe are not aware of this what this is all about and, in a sense, what it says about the current state of affairs in this part of the world.
During the Cold War, alliances were quite rightly concentrated in the Atlantic area, even before the European Union today, or the European Economic Community of the 50s and later, and NATO set up in 1949. The British especially were brokering involvement of the U.S. and Canada, please don't forget, with Western Europe. And there's a whole network of intergovernmental, non-governmental, non-profit organizations of all kinds. Quite farsightedly, the United States, after Vietnam, it's also a complicated history, but much less visible. We started, perhaps Nixon's visit to China in 72 might be an important benchmark for all kinds of reasons, including the fact that Germany, not Japan, was the priority during World War II. We tended to neglect the Pacific. But since 85, we've had a greater trade volume with the Pacific than with than across the Atlantic with Europe. And there's steadily growing involvement of all kinds. And RIMPAC is about, I believe, 30 nations that get together annually for military exercises. It includes South American nations. It includes Israel, I believe. And it's one of the most important of a series of alliances that Washington has been assiduously developing. The British are involved, quite rightly, as usual, international leaders. And while the media is concentrating on the exaggerated danger of China, this growing network of institutions is extremely important.
Right.
It also includes South Korea and Japan. And there are other increasingly strong military collaborations involving South Korea and Japan, traditional enemies, that are now spurred by the military rise of China, that are now cooperating actively.
You said something to the effect that there were like 25,000 different vessels that were part of this.
I mean, yes.
What a thing to see and to experience.
Yeah, absolutely tremendous. Well, the Pacific is a maritime theater, much more than the Atlantic and Europe.
Right.
Whether it's tourism or it's trade and finance or military activity.
Let's spend our last few minutes talking about this current presidential campaign, but for a moment, let's focus on the column you wrote not long after the telecast of the vice presidential debate between Senator J.D. Vance and Governor Tim Walz, who, in your estimation, and I think in the estimation of most who watched the debate, behaved like two adults.
Two gentlemen. Never hear that term anymore.
Imagine such a thing.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention, part of what you talk about in this column is that vice presidents matter.
Yeah,
and
they
matter more than we often realize. I wanted to acknowledge that I recently did an interview with the writer-producer of a wonderful documentary called The American Vice President that aired on PBS's American Experience, which talked, among other things, about how when the Founding Fathers were kind of putting together the Constitution and the nuts and bolts of our government, that they kind of ran out of time when it came to the vice presidency and did next to nothing in terms of laying out specific duties or laying out the specific mechanism of when a president dies, what happens? And, you know, is the vice president suddenly the president, or is he just the acting president, or so on? I mean, none of that groundwork was laid. They just didn't take the time to do it. And so for most of our history, we've lived with a great ambiguity about the vice presidency and also this matter of succession and so on. And then the documentary explores the means by which finally that was addressed. But, of course, you very rightly point out that the significance of the vice presidency was very much elevated by Vice President Nixon.
Absolutely.
And in part when he participated in that first dramatic televised debate with John F. Kennedy. So clearly this vice presidential debate between Mr. Vance and Mr. Walz, while important in and of itself, you want us to understand it in a wider context.
Yes, well, thank you very much. You're always so kind and complimentary. Richard Nixon created the modern vice presidency. John Nance Garner, who was FDR's vice president for two terms, a blunt Texas politician, has famously said it was not worth a pitcher of warm spit. At least that's what got through the media censorship at the time.
Right. He might have said it differently, but yes.
Vice presidents historically have become president, but now, thanks to Nixon, a vice president is usually considered a contender. You're quite right. He was path-breaking. He agreed to debate with Kennedy. Eisenhower advised him not to do it. Others did as well. And to his credit, Nixon said yes, and to Kennedy's credit, he and his father very aggressively pursued media opportunities of all kinds throughout his career. Lyndon Johnson and Nixon, the second time around in 68, understandably decided no debates.
Hmm.
But Gerald Ford agreed in 1976, and we can thank Richard Nixon again in the chaos and really terrible atmosphere of Watergate, these scandals that consumed his administration and forced him to resign. He picked Gerald Ford as his successor after Spiro Agnew, Nixon's very corrupt vice president, was forced to resign. And Gerald Ford was kind of the ultimate good guy. He was an honest man. He was very bipartisan. He was in many ways the ideal successor. And so for lots of reasons, I think we can thank poor Nixon at that point for picking him. And Ford did agree to debate with the unknown Jimmy Carter and also agreed to vice presidential debates between Walter Mondale, Carter's running mate, and Bob Dole. In those days, a very effective, very smart, but very, very rough and extraordinarily partisan, rather mean-tempered Republican senator. And Dole was so terrible on TV and kept attacking Democrat wars, and he looked like he was going to personally go after Mondale. And he was badly shot up in Italy and literally left for dead. Fortunately, a soldier noticed this guy was still breathing in the pile of corpses. Bob Dole had a hard time. But he came across so badly that it probably cost Ford the election. He barely lost to the unknown Jimmy Carter. And that established the tradition. We've had them continuously. George H. And they can affect a race. George H. W. Bush picked Dan Quayle, a relatively unknown Indiana senator, as his running mate. Bush, an extraordinarily talented and accomplished man. James Baker, his closest associate, wondered why the hell he had done this. Quayle seemed remarkably immature, and was in strange ways, and really was a drag on Bush, not for initial election, but during the reelection campaign against, Bill Clinton in 1992. I met Quayle. I spent 2 decades at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, and we once a year at least would do a conference at Wingspread, the Johnson Foundation Conference Center, right next door here. They were committed to the UN and foreign policy education in those days, and John Riley, the council president, developed a very good rapport with Les Paffrath, the longtime president there. And by chance, we had a conference, it must have been in the 80s, with Senator Quayle. His staff was very fond of him. He was the featured speaker. He was from a very wealthy Indiana family, and he seemed very much like a very rich boy. There was something very soft and mild about his face and his whole demeanor, and his staff was very much some of them seemed almost in love with him and would treat him very kindly, but he did not seem like a U.S. senator. There was absolutely no fear factor, none of the usual stuff connected with D.C. And at the time, I was a little startled that Bush had picked him as his running mate. So that can certainly affect an election. I myself think this time around, J.D., given Trump's style, I think J.D. Vance probably did the campaign some good by behaving himself the way he did. So that's my opinion. But I really urge people to look into the vice presidency.
It matters.
Yeah.
So we have...
It does matter, and particularly thanks to Nixon.
Sure. And, of course, this upcoming presidential election matters as well. We just have, literally 2 minutes.
Ah!
But
I talk too much, Greg.
No, it's all been great. But I wonder if you have anything you want to say in terms of about this decision that confronts the American people.
Oh, the election?
This upcoming election.
Well, I'm not going to add to the downbeat gloom and gloom, and I'm certainly not going to add to the poison. Turnout is very high. In the legendary 60 campaign between Kennedy and Nixon, turnout was low. I don't know why. I don't think anybody else does either. I think it was partly the Eisenhower effect. Everything was so calm and peaceful. It was hard to get excited. The media was excited, of course, and activists were excited, and people like you and me. But we used to fret about low turnout, and that's no longer the case.
Right. There seems to be an energy about the land on both sides of the aisle, for sure. And, of course, with this appearing to be an incredibly close race, we will just have to see how it plays out, and then we'll have more to talk about.
That's a huge structural change in our system. As usual, you put your finger. That's the fact that a few battleground states now determine things.
Right.
Big change.
Right. Well, we will see how all of that plays out, and then, of course, we'll be talking about that and other significant events and issues of the day with Dr. Art Sear. Professor Sear, I welcome and appreciate each and every opportunity we have to have you join us on the morning show and appreciate your presence today and look forward to your future visits to the program.
Well, thank you. You set the standard, and I always learn a lot, and I enjoy this.
Thank you.
Unlike other media encounters.
Glad to have you with us. Yes, thank you for being part of the morning show. Tomorrow on the morning show, it will be the first of a two-part interview that I have recorded with one of our most renowned current composers of song, musical theater, and opera, his name, Ricky Ian Gordon. And he has written an incredibly honest memoir called Seeing Through, a chronicle of sex, drugs, and opera, in which Ricky Ian Gordon talks about the fascinating personal and professional life that he has enjoyed. And part one of that conversation will be airing tomorrow on the morning show. The concluding half of it will air on Monday. Also upcoming here on Tuesday, a conversation with William Cope Moyers, the son of journalist Bill Moyers, and one of the most compelling voices when it comes to the matters of addiction and recovery and sobriety. His best-selling memoir, Broken, was published back in 2007, his newest memoir is titled Broken Open, in which he talks about his most recent years and an ongoing battle which he has waged with addiction to painkillers. And that, of course, that whole opioid epidemic is a crisis that a lot of us are well acquainted with. But William Cope Moyers has experienced it firsthand and writes about it with disarming honesty in his new book. The occasion for this conversation is that William Cope Moyers is coming to southeastern Wisconsin as one of the keynote speakers for the 15th annual Help and Hope Conference on Substance Use Disorders on Friday, November 1st. So again, this newly recorded conversation with him will be heard on the Tuesday morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org, and available as a podcast 7 days a week. Our weather forecast calls for skies to be mostly sunny today, and we are headed for a high of 63 degrees. Overnight low will be 49 degrees. Tomorrow's high, much like today, partly cloudy skies, slight chance of showers. Tomorrow's high, 62 degrees. Emphatically sunny skies both Saturday and Sunday. Daytime highs will range from the upper 50s to the low 60s. A slight chance of showers, and we'll actually have a brief warm-up period early next week. It looks like daytime highs, briefly, will be back into the mid-70s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake